From Variety, I'm Michael Schneider. Better Call Saul star Bob Odenkirk marvels these days at how good television has become.
You know, we churn so much TV out in America, and so for many years, and I don't know if it's still the case, but in England it was, 12 episodes, right, and you're done, you know, six per season, and then one special. And I think the time they took making all those shows probably lent itself to just a higher quality.
Yeah,
now the landscape has changed, and we're seeing amazing shows here. You know, the marketplace has gone to a place that's encouraging quality now, which is crazy.
On this edition of the podcast, we talked to Bob Odenkirk about the comedies that influenced him over the years and how he feels about Hulu's Pen 15 and even how it matches those classic shows. We also talk about his mixed feelings about being a producer and where he thinks Better Call Saul is going. It's my favorite episode.
My favorite episode. Let's talk TV. My favorite episode makes me so happy. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Variety's My Favorite Episode. Let's give it up for your host, Michael Schneider.
Thank you, DJ Omar Khan, for the theme song. It's my favorite episode, and this time out, we're talking to Bob Odenkirk, also known as Jimmy McGill / Saul Goodman, on AMC's Better Call Saul. Odenkirk's pick is Anna Ishii Peters, the ninth episode from season one of Hulu's critically acclaimed Pen 15. Written by Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle, who received an Emmy nomination recently for their script, and directed by Sam Zivelman, Pen 15 stars Erskine and Conkle as 13-year-old versions of themselves, coping with the onset of adolescence.
Seventh grade is going to be so amazing.
It's going to be really, really good.
It's going to be like the best year of our lives.
You're 13. Can you still play with dolls?
How dare you do this to me, bitch?
Alex broke up with Heather.
It's happening.
I guess he like loves me or whatever.
I'm really, 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 really sorry. It's Jill.
In the episode that Odenkirk chose, while her parents are away on a couple's retreat, Anna sleeps over at the house of her best friend, Maya. While the two start out excited at getting a chance to act like sisters, soon Maya grows jealous of Anna, who bonds with Maya's mother in a way that Maya can't. We sat down with Odenkirk recently and began by discussing all of the other shows he was pondering while choosing his favorite episode.
And I have to explain my choice of my favorite TV episode.
Yeah, well,
and I'm happy to explain it.
Yeah, yeah. It's
obviously there's a lot of great TV that sticks in my mind from when I was young.
Yeah,
and that stuck with me and motivated me to try to be a part of this business.
Name a couple of those.
Sure, definitely Monty Python. The episode with Deja Vu is one I would point to as like a bit of a mind blower, you know, Deja Vu, where they keep repeating. It's a TV show called Deja Vu, but it keeps repeating itself and shocking the host of the show who thought he had already started the show.
Yeah.
It's so great.
Yeah.
And it's so funny and so well constructed. And imagine just when I must have been 12 years old when I saw it, you know.
Yeah.
Around there, and it just blew my mind about what you could do and how you could be funny in a direct, funny, silly way, and also in a kind of absurdist way, and it could make sense too. I love that. I actually like The Goodies, but I haven't seen that since I was a little kid, since I was 11 or 12. So I'm told it doesn't wear well.
Doesn't hold up.
Which I believe is probably true. But Kitty Kong sticks in my head. And the one where the butterfly has a mirror on its back and the sun melts the North Pole reflecting off the mirror. And then the Winter Olympics have to be held underwater. And then there's another one where they dig a hole in their apartment to the center of the earth. Now, I don't know if those episodes are any good. That was pretty broad comedy they were all out of the same school as Python, literally the same university, but the same comedy school of taking the Peter Sellers Goon Show vibe and, you know, taking it further and being having a lot of fun with it in a silly hippie-ish way. But
absurdist, right?
Yeah, absurdist. And I think they're just kind of broader, sillier swipes than Python, which was smarter and drier and more self-aware. And
So anyways,
I did love the goodies. I mean, it stuck in my head. And then let me see what else.
Well, I was going to say, but both of those kind of put them together. I mean, obvious inspiration for Mr. Show.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. Yeah, for sure.
I mean, obvious to me and I'm sure to most. So.
Also... You know, geez, there's other things that influenced Mr. Show. I know David is not a big fan of Fire Sign Theater, but I think they did some really great, smart stuff. That's record albums.
Yeah.
That's not TV. And I think definitely influenced Mr. Show.
Yeah.
And it was really good stuff. I think We're All Bozos on This Bus is really an amazing piece of audio imagination and humor. Anyway, TV, we're here to talk about TV. Let's talk about... The things that stick in my head, SCTV, the episode where they, it wasn't actually an SCTV episode. It was, Martin Short was part of it. Andrew Alexander produced it. So, but it played during the SCTV time slot one time. It was a Cisco kid with, dubbed. Cisco Kid episode dubbed, and you hear Martin Short's voice, and I think somebody else from SCTV participated. I thought it was on during SCTV's time slot, and I thought it was so mind-blowing to turn on SCTV, and here's the Cisco Kid, and you're like, what's going on? And it's comedy, obviously, and then you can tell it's Martin Short's voice, and you're like, are they going to do the whole episode? This is before Riff Tracks, before all those people.
Yeah, remember Mad Movies?
Yeah. No.
Yeah, that was in the 80s where it was like a syndicated show. I think it was on Nick at Night where they took old movies and completely redubbed them. And sounds a lot like what they did that one episode.
And that's what they did. And then I learned just last week because I've never seen it since. It's good. It's not great. It's on YouTube. But at the time, nobody had done this, and certainly no one had done it outside of kids in their living rooms. Nobody who were professional comedians had done an entire episode and put it on TV. It was so great.
Yeah. And the fact that they sort of did it almost unannounced.
Totally unannounced. As it turns out, I read about it. It was some kind of like... side producing project of Andrew Alexander. They were trying to get it off the ground. I don't think they did, but they did that one episode. And then let me see what else. I wanted to talk about The Royal Family, which is my favorite sitcom ever, and it's spelled R-O-Y-L-E for Americans.
Yeah, and I remember they tried to do an American version, actually.
Yes, and they did a
didn't last
shit
long.
Job of it, yeah. I'm sure.
Unfortunately.
It's terrible.
Yeah, but you like the original.
It's one of the smartest. It's, you know, my favorite sitcom ever, and it's because... Look, the BBC Office is unbelievable. It's so great. The fact that the Royal Family is about a family and the way in which the family dynamic slowly becomes apparent as you watch it and sort of the subtext of everyone's relationships, you have to watch it for four or five episodes before you start to realize how the daughter plays the father and she's been indulged her whole life and just the wife and the husband and the way in which there just seems to be no love in that room, and yet in the end there's this warmth that where does it come from? Can't even watching it, all you see are people enabling each other's weaknesses and faults, and And yet in the end, there's just a feeling of warmth and, I don't want to say supportiveness or kind of warm. It's just a love.
Yeah.
And I don't know where they find that in that world that they created, but they were able to infuse it with that somehow in the most underhanded way. And it's really, really funny.
Yeah.
And the more you know it, the funnier it is. The more you know what reaction you're going to get from the mom or the daughter. I've watched it 3 times now. Once with my son when he was young. He was about 10 years old. And you have to have the subtitles on because it's a family in Manchester. Mm-hmm. And they have very strong accents. And I thought he wouldn't be able to, you know, watch it. But he loved it. He absolutely loved it. He got all the comedy and all the feeling out of it that's there. I picked episode 3. If I was going to talk about the royal family, I would have chosen episode 3, which is they're all great, but episode 3 is kind of just a very solid example of the hardest thing they do, which is make a lot out of nothing. It's most of the show is the family watching TV, and you watch them watch TV, and then they just chit chat.
Yeah, they're just in the living room, and the play on the royal family being this, you know, they couldn't be less like the royal family, but yet ultimately they're probably more cohesive as a unit than the actual royal family in real life in Buckingham Palace.
So. And it's super funny and super smart about human beings. And the British Office I absolutely love. And I also, of course, love Catastrophe, which is almost a show I chose. And I'm sorry to my friends who run that show that I didn't choose that show. Because I would point to the first episode of Catastrophe and the first episode of the second season.
Yeah.
Where you were wondering what choice they would make, and they made such an amazing choice. And then the last episode of the third season, which is just blows your mind what's going on there.
Yeah.
But I didn't choose Catastrophe. I didn't choose The Royal Family. I didn't choose The Goodies. I didn't choose Monty Python. I chose Pen 15.
Well, real quick before we go to Pen
15. And I know the name Odenkirk is on there, but
we'll get to that.
Please forget about
we'll get
that.
To that.
But I have nothing to do with it.
First, I wanted to ask you real quick about all these British comedies. Clearly, that was an influence. What is it about the British humor that...
I think about it as my humor.
Yeah.
I don't think of it as British humor.
Yeah. But something about that British style of dry wit.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I thought the Steve Martin hosted episodes of Saturday Night Live were great fun and had an amazing energy that inspired me. But you can't beat the level of intelligence and care that. You know, we churn so much TV out in America, and so for many years, and I don't know if it's still the case, but in England it was 12 episodes
right.
and you're done, 6 per season, and then one special. And I think the time they took making all those shows, probably lent itself to just a higher quality.
Yeah, it was usually
all.
Maybe
it's not about them being British.
Or dry or absurdist, or maybe there's a little bit of that. But then, you're right, it's usually one writer who writes it all. So it's very consistent, and it comes from one person's voice. And so there's something special about those 6 or 8 episodes.
I suppose that's a reason. And I don't know, I mean, America's about churning that shit out. Yeah, now the landscape has changed, and we're seeing amazing shows here. The one I picked, Pen 15, and I love the Kominsky method. There's just great stuff. I think Catastrophe could be an American show.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's here. Half American with Rob Delaney, so there is that. In some ways, American TV has sort of caught up with the way British TV used to be
in
doing these
shorter
orders.
Yeah, the industry is you know, the marketplace has allowed, has gone to a place that's encouraging quality now, which is crazy.
Yeah. And a lot more of these original voices, like Maya and Anna on Pen 15.
Yeah.
So, okay, so take me to Pen 15. Now, this comes from one of the production companies involved happens to be your wife's.
Yes. I didn't even know that. You know, she said, watch this show. I didn't know that her company had produced it. And so I, you know, I was just watching a show. And I, of course, like everybody heard that the conceit or one of, you know, that the two adult actresses who wrote it, we're going to play 13-year-olds surrounded by actual 13-year-olds. And, of course, that sounded a little like a sketch taken to you know, show length. And that automatically kind of made me exhausted and dread what I was going to see. And, of course, and if you've watched the show, you know that you soon stop thinking about their age, the actual age of the actresses, because they embody those kids that they play so completely, physically, in their eyes, the language of it is just, you lose yourself as they lose themselves in those characters. You lose yourself in the world that they're in. And that show, look, in thinking about all these classic shows that I love from so long ago, there's just no way to beat what's going on right now in TV.
Yeah,
I mean, come on. The layers of comedy and humanity in Pen 15 rival everything else. The Royal Family, BBC Office, everything else. And it's more inventive and slightly more challenging. And the other thing that's happening is the direction, and I don't know this guy, but Sam Zwiebelman is the director of all the episodes. And there's a quality to the direction and the choices in production and post-production that elevate the emotion of it and the complexity of what you're seeing far beyond what TV could have been even 20, 30 years ago, 15 years ago even. And there's the music and the performances of Melora Walters and who plays the dad? Those two in this episode, episode 9, which is called Anna Ishii Peters.
Yeah, Taylor Nichols is the dad, plays Curtis Cohn. So, but I mean, the other thing that
Taylor Nichols, Melora Walters as the parents of Anna.
Yeah, Anna Conkle, yeah.
Are amazing, you know. In that episode, I hope someone notices how great the both of them are.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that's also amazing about, you mentioned sort of the directing of this episode and the performances and sort of the look of it. And this was a show that was done on a shoestring budget.
Hard to believe.
A tiny, tiny show.
Very hard to believe.
Yeah.
I mean, wonderfully shot. It's just so well put together and They hit every chord. They hit every feeling. There's humor and broad humor and silly humor, and there's heartache in this episode.
Yeah,
all played so well.
Well, so this is a show that comes from such a personal place. So Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle, who are the creators of the show, they star in the show. It's sort of based on, you know, their life as seventh graders, but it's a relatable show. I mean, watching it, I have to every once in a while look away or pause it because it's, you know, it's sort of that cringe that you get from remembering
the
what
BBC
it was like.
Office.
Yeah, exactly.
The last time I felt that cringe was watching Ricky Gervais as David Brent do cringy things where you can't believe. You do want to walk away or stop it because it's just horrible.
Yeah, you're embarrassed
but
for them.
It's so goddamn funny.
Yeah.
And these girls are the same way. You're laughing and you're feeling bad, so bad for these girls trying to figure out who they are and make it through this tough time of life.
Yeah, not knowing friendships change, your relationship with your parents change, and it's you don't know who you are, so you overcompensate.
Oh, God, it's
and
so funny.
Yeah,
and it's so sad when the parents talk about I mean, I don't know about spoiler alerts on a show that's just running.
It's been out since February, so
the parents tell her they're getting divorced. It's just that's as good as it gets.
Yeah,
and for everyone involved in that scene.
Yeah, and what's especially heartbreaking is then she had just had a fight with her best friend Maya, and so she tries to call Maya nonetheless because she just needs to talk to her best friend, but Maya's asleep, doesn't answer the phone, so that leads to. Yeah, you know, so a furthering of the rift between these two. And, you know, watching the finale, you know, there's a beautiful scene where they do reconnect. And, you know, it all leads up to this goofy, awkward dance that they do that reestablishes their relationship. But it's a lovely 10 episodes that are well worth your time. It's only 5 hours. Easy to,
to
binge.
I'm going
to
watch the whole thing again for sure. No question. I'll watch it at least one more time, the whole series.
Yeah, but this episode that you mentioned, it is great. So it's called Anna Ishii Peters, and the idea is Anna's parents are away, a retreat trying to rekindle their relationship. So Anna's staying with her best friend Maya, and at first they are just so excited. They're going to be sisters. They're loving it. They're very awkward. But then Maya gets jealous of Anna.
Anna's so happy to be in a family where the parents are attendant and care and...
Yeah,
and
Maya had taken it so for granted that she never helped her mom wash dishes and just didn't care. And then when she sees Anna being the good daughter and her mom
loving Anna,
yeah,
but not over. It's all in Maya's mind.
Yeah,
it really is. But also, you understand it. Her friend comes over, and her friend keeps hanging out with the mom.
Yeah.
And helping the mom, and the mom keeps saying, "You're doing great, and thank you." And of course, her friend's mom is just a nightmare. Parents are both nightmares. So she's enjoying this family vibe. Yeah. And it's one great moment after another.
And by the way,
cringy and sad as can be.
And that's Maya Erskine's real mom playing her
which
mom.
Which is crazy.
Which is crazy.
Because she's great. She's great.
Yeah.
It's not – sometimes this kind of pranky casting happens and people praise it. And I'm like, yeah, but – what'd they do? They said hello and walked through the room. You know, like her mom is acting and carrying on with scenes. And in this episode, there's scenes with her daughter, Maya.
Yeah.
You know, in real life and in the fake world. But her daughter's 13 and is just having her period for the first time in this episode.
Yeah.
And those are complex scenes.
Yeah, and there's that one scene at the end where Maya is crying on her mom's lap, and but she's playing 13-year-old Maya, and her mom is playing a different version of herself. And this is not an actress. It's not a trained actress, but she has to play this emotional scene with her real-life daughter, but as a 13-year-old, and there must have been flashback. That must have been a really interesting, emotional, real-life thing for them to reenact something
when
that could have happened.
Maya, you need to grow up. You're not a little girl anymore. She says, I think, you're not a little girl anymore. To try to get a person who isn't an actor to do that line right, would be impossible, except that she's got the soul of an actor, that woman, and she's smart as can be, and she gets it because she does it perfectly. She's unaware that her daughter had her period and hasn't told her yet, and she's just talking about referring to her frustrations, her daughter's acting out because she's giving attention to the daughter's friend. And but the line hits, in so many ways. And she doesn't do it. Most non-actors would not understand to do it with the restraint that she does it and the naturalness that she does it with. She's amazing.
Yeah.
Give her an Emmy. She won't know what it means. She'll look at it and go, what is this?
Wouldn't that be amazing? speaking of family, so you mentioned this is your wife's management company, production company, along with Mark Provocero. And I remember actually talking to Mark a couple months ago when he first brought up, you got to see this show, Pen 15. It's amazing like how they managed to.
Anna's a client of their management company, so.
How often do you sort of like, do you talk shop with your wife? Does she like show you every once in a while, like, oh, you got to watch this?
Or? She does. But like, for instance, she wouldn't tell me that that was produced by her company. She shows me all kinds of things that have nothing to do with anything she's part of. She gets very excited about it. There's so many young actors and actresses who she shows me. And I go, so do you rep them? And she's like, no, they already have a manager. And, you know, she doesn't like poach people. So, like, well, why are you so excited about them? Just, they don't, you know, like, but she can't help herself.
Yeah.
She loves what she loves. And she loves young actors and actresses and talented writers and people who are doing something interesting. And she can't help it. She sets up showcases for people who have other managers. she works hard and she puts out flyers. I'm like, but you don't rep them, right? She said, yeah, but they're so great. They're coming in from Chicago. They're only here for 2 nights. I want to make sure people see them. Yeah, but you don't. What?
She just loves the craft.
She loves what she does. And she particularly loves finding unknown talent and who nobody's talking about and sharing it with everybody.
Yeah.
Trying to get the word out.
So that's interesting. I mean, again, talking about your mix of creative family members.
I mean, I'm kind of the same way, but not to the extent she is. But I kind of always feel that way too, you know.
Yeah.
There's people that who I find so great, and my friend Andre Hyland, who has done so much funny, odd stuff, and he'll find his way, but it's been brutal.
Yeah.
You know, watching this guy who makes stuff, makes interesting stuff and funny stuff and unique. And he'll get there. But sometimes it takes so many years for people to find the best place for themselves to showcase what they do.
What about you as a producer? How do you enjoy putting the producer hat on, or what's
I have such mixed feelings about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've produced a lot of stuff, most of it a long time ago. I'm probably going to do it again, you know, just because I feel like a Catholic responsibility to do something that I can do and help other people who need, you know, maybe a voice to champion them and make their way in their career. But it's not easy. Like Better Call Saul, I made a joke the other night that, you know, I have the executive producer credit, but I don't help.
you don't exercise that and power.
And it's true. It's kind of true.
Yeah.
And it's because I said, you know, you can give me the credit, but I want to be the actor on this show. I want to lose myself in the role and not be worried about what time it is, how much time we have to shoot, what are we shooting tomorrow, is it going to rain? All the things a producer has to worry about getting this whole project done. They have to concern themselves with the bigger world. And I don't want to do that. I want to just be Jimmy McGill, Saul Goodman. And it's really, for me, acting has been a wonderful vacation from who I am when I'm not acting, which is like this movie I have to write, and I want to help with this show, and I want to figure out this show idea, and sort of overseeing all these projects. When you're acting, you really need to zen out and focus on this one person and what's going on in their world, and you need to let it become your whole universe for a few hours a day.
Yeah.
And that's kind of wonderful. It's challenging, and when it's a heavy dramatic scene, and you're feeling all kinds of strong feelings, it can be hard, you know, to stay in that place mentally for 8 hours. But it's for me, in so many ways, it's been a joy and a break from everything that came before it.
Yeah.
And so I've enjoyed it. So I don't want to burden myself when I'm acting with all the extraneous concerns that a producer should be worried about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you have a lot on your shoulders on Better Call Saul being number one on the call sheet. I mean, this is an intense, complicated role, and to...
Well, you know, because you're playing, but to me, the job of acting is the same, which is be this guy, care about what he cares about only, and think about think about existing in his shoes and seeing the world through his eyes, and not anything else. What were we talking about?
As this show gets more complex, it's becoming more complicated for you.
Thing is, what's different about being the lead is not really a difference in the job, right? The job is the same as being a character actor or being a side character in a show. But what you're given to do changes, which is to say your character, most of the time a character in the a side character is really, really reacting. They're really only ever reacting. But a lead character isn't just reacting to the plot as it moves or the people around him or the situation he finds himself in. But the lead character is oftentimes reacting or exhibiting a kind of his psychological truth. That kind of makes choices that are independent of can be independent of the pressures of the moment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Walter White is supposed to return the sports car because his wife's like, you can't buy that for our son. You know, that's insane. You know, and he takes it on a joyride. That joyride is nothing to do with anything except his brain and his psychology.
Yeah,
he should just return it or sell it or do any number of things with it and get it away from the house and from the kid. But inside him comes out, and you get to go to those places when you're the lead. That stuff is on screen. In Fargo, the first season of Fargo, I had a wonderful role. Lieutenant Bill, detective. Well, no, I'm sorry, Deputy Bill, and he kind of has these moments as the show progresses. Noah Hawley gave the character kind of a lead role moments in the show where he shows up with this kid who he's kind of adopting,
right.
You know, and gives this long explanation of finding this kid and wanting to help him. And it's just completely unnecessary to the plot.
Yeah, it's almost like he's got his own show going on.
He's got his own show going on, which is a tribute to Noah and I think a tribute to the kind of TV we all get to watch now.
Yeah,
And where they can go in a drama, which that more than anything, when people talk about the way in which a modern TV drama can be like a 10-hour feature, that in a way is what a feature film used to be able to do that TV never did. Give secondary characters more self-motivation, more a wholeness to their universe.
Mm-hmm.
That's something you might find in a movie. A feature that you never found in TV, and now you find it in TV all over the place, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, especially.
And you find it in Pen 15.
Yeah.
Every character is justified, you know? The parents are not just awful people. Anna's parents in that show are not just awful people. They're people who are trying to make it work. They're going away for a weekend to try to get their relationship to work. And it's just going to fail miserably.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's the benefit of the serialized nature of television now. And speaking of Better Call Saul, asked you to pick a favorite episode, which I know is tough.
You know, it's not even that. It's all one story to me, and the way I think maybe the way I look at it, I often tell people I watch it just like a fan watches it. In some ways, that's true. I don't read other people's parts that closely when I read the script, so that when I watch the episode, I can enjoy what happens with Lalo and Nacho and Gus and that world. That can be kind of more fresh to me because I didn't read it closely, because intentionally I want to watch it just like you do and go, oh my God, he's going to do that?
Yeah. Since it really is two shows in one.
It's fun for me. Yeah. Pretty soon that will change, I think.
Yeah.
And I'm not, no spoiler alert, but it has to change.
The worlds eventually collide.
They have to come together.
Yeah.
And soon. And, it's just for me, I don't know. I'm living that guy's life. I don't know where it goes or what happens next, but it is hard for me to see those as episodes.
Yeah.
It's almost hard to see them in a chapterized form that an episode puts it in. I just see this experience that's kind of mutating and it's kind of alive.
Yeah.
And I don't want to make myself see that stuff. The things I like best about Better Call Saul are such small things that I don't think people almost see them happen. There's two scenes with myself and Ray as Kim and Jimmy. In one's in the bathroom, one's in the over the kitchen counter in her apartment in season four. I think one's in episode 5, but I'm not sure. And there were, she asked me if I'm going to, she encourages me to go see a therapist, and there's almost a misunderstanding between them. And then Jimmy sits down on this edge of the bathtub and he's really lost. And she says, you should go see somebody. And he says, maybe I will. And then later she says, I thought you were going to see that therapist. And he says, I don't think that's for me. And the way in which the characters trade that information and take in that information is really special to me. Mm-hmm. It's the way a real couple would do it. A lot of people would make a bigger turn. Even Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad writers would oftentimes make a bigger turn out of the fact that she asked him to see a therapist, she gave him a number, and he's telling her, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
And they don't. They treat it, I think, more like a real relationship that wants to carry on, where she takes in that information and allows him that space to make his own choice. And even though it's something she really wants him to do, she doesn't go, God damn it, you told me you'd do this, and now we're going to make conflict out of that, and there's going to be drama out of that choice, because she really, it's important to her. But they make these two people make space for each other and forgive each other for almost, you could say, lies. In the way, I hope my wife doesn't hear this, in the way that a real couple needs to have some flexibility around each other.
Yeah.
For you said you'd do that thing, that small thing, or I really want this, and you know I want it. And they just make room for each other to grow. Like, I know maybe you're not ready for this yet, and that's okay.
Yeah.
I'm still going to be by your side.
It's a subtle negotiation.
It's a subtle, breathing that they allow the relationship to do, that my God, that's as complex as and real as anything in life.
Yeah.
And it's a small thing. It's not there's no one's crying. You're not going to get an Emmy for it, but you should. I'm not saying we should get an Emmy. I'm saying every show that does that that has those real feeling moments. Hey, look, Pen 15, where the parents tell her, the way they tell her is so hard for them. That complexity is something I value so much and I love so much, and that everyone's so proud of TV for going there and the writers for going there. But you know what? The reason they go there is because the audience lets you.
Yeah.
And the audience says, has had, because they were given the chance to by desperate network executives who had no other thing to put on and then put on, you know, these challenging shows.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have if they could have chosen anything else. But because they're backed into a corner, TV sometimes makes weird choices, challenging choices, and the audience goes, yeah, yeah, we're up for that. And then everyone's like surprised because they were never given the opportunity to be up for that, to choose that thing, because it was never no one ever took a risk to put it on. But we find that there's an audience out there totally willing to watch human beings struggle and do things on a big scale, on a grand scale, but also on a really small macro scale. Is it macro or micro? Micro, right? I don't understand macro and micro. But anyway, yeah. You know what I'm getting at.
Yeah, no, I do. And it's. I think about going back to Kim and Jimmy. Another good example this past season is Kim's ongoing hope that, you know, there's a certain way she would love Jimmy to react to Chuck's death, and she's just not getting it, and she's not forcing him to grieve or forcing him to act that certain way, but you could tell she really wishes that.
It really disturbs her.
Yeah.
That has been a bit of a struggle, because everyone acknowledges that people grieve in their own way. And grief can be a very strange thing.
Yeah.
A person you care about deeply and love and attend to and spend a great deal of time with can die, and you can not feel anything. You can be numb. Your brain can go to a completely different place immediately. And almost as much as you try to feel bad, you can't feel bad.
Yeah.
And you almost can ask, am I a sociopath? You know?
Right.
But the truth is, your grief, everyone grieves in their own way. And, you know, then they find themselves 2 years later, 5 years later, 15 years later, weeping over the loss of that person. That, you know, it's almost like a compartmentalization that your body and brain do on their own that you have no power over.
Yeah, particularly when your relationship was so complicated and complex, just like Jimmy and Chuck.
Exactly.
Yeah, to the very
end. I don't
end.
Think his reaction is wrong. I think he should be allowed his reaction.
To do it in his own way, yeah.
To grieve in his own way and to take in. As I said to Peter and Vince when we talked about this issue, I said, for me, that character, Chuck, the way Chuck treated him, how Chuck died, their complications of their relationship is not something you experience in a moment of grief and woe and 3 days of tears. It's something that echoes through the rest of your life. I mean, it's the relationship and the incidents that you talk about and think about for the rest of your life.
Yeah,
it kind of plays out. However long you get to live, it continues to play out.
Yeah, and that's one of the great things about having those episodes to explore the first three seasons of Better Call Saul was to really like see that relationship, the highs and the lows between these two brothers, and really get to this point where you can really understand this is how.
I think one of the reasons I love those small moments between Kim and Jimmy is because, to a great extent, Kim, you feel that the two of them are destined for different paths. They just must go in separate ways. So what keeps them together? Well, those little moments say a lot. Those little moments say, to me, they actually could make it. And when you look at couples like, who's that woman who does Trump's bidding? And what's her name?
Which
the one whose husband is
Conway. Kellyanne Conway.
Kellyanne Conway and her husband. You wonder, like, how does that work? Well, it works like that. You know, you're allowed to think anything you want about the world and approach the world any way you want. When we're together, I make space for that, and I guess there's kind of a love on the level of, it's kind of like the two people each are pursuing their lives with the same seriousness, and they recognize that in each other.
Yeah.
Both Kim and Jimmy are serious about realizing their dreams and becoming who they can be. And they see that in each other, and they encourage that in each other and support each other in that. Then whatever that specific choice is, they have a little less, they care less, or they think they do. I think Kim cares a little more about Jimmy, and I think is asking herself more, wait, how does my dream of being a respected lawyer who does important things, a Lincoln-esque lawyer, how does that work if my partner really wants to be this chaotic, anarchic, burn everything down lawyer, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I'm not sure that works. And she's probably right. That's a challenge.
Yeah, it's a shame Kim has to die. No, actually, no.
I don't know.
I mean, by the way,
I don't think.
No,
by the way, everybody can't die.
No,
right?
I'm pretty convinced she doesn't at this point, because we're not that far away from the events of Breaking Bad, and I think if Kim had died, Saul would not. He would have broken down.
He wouldn't carry on that way.
No.
Yeah.
He wouldn't be that. He wouldn't be Saul. So something happens, but not that devastating.
I agree. I also think it's just the writers seem to relish complication and challenge, and so it's less challenging to have her die, and it's more challenging to have her live and be, you know, right there.
Yeah.
And he is going to live this life, you know, within 2 miles of her and do this. You know, that there's a lot in that. There's a lot in the fact that he's going to be this brazen. And I don't know what happens. She might die. But I just think that the writers probably, they seem to pursue the hardest choice and then trying to justify that and make it all flow. And they do it.
Yeah.
So in this case, to me, that choice is that they are still there, and they even still love each other.
Yeah, yeah. I'm convinced one of these years we'll see a black and white shot of Jean sort of like finding Kim and watching her from afar in her new life.
Wouldn't the color come back into his world then?
So maybe. Well, it depends. Depends if he's able to actually communicate with her. If he can't, if he's only watching from afar, then it's still he's still tortured.
I'm excited about Jean. That's the older version of Saul and Jimmy. I'm excited about what can happen with Gene's life.
Yeah, the show could continue for a long time.
Yeah, needs to straighten up his look. But I think if he could approach life from a different vantage point, he could find a third wind, a fifth wind.
Yeah, yeah. The future of this show could be Gene.
Let's see what happens.
So what is it like for you? And you're about to go back into production
tomorrow. I fly back. Yeah.
Wow. So what's that like on the eve of getting back into this role, this world that's going to consume you for the next several months?
It's nerve-wracking because I want to do justice to where we left off, and I haven't been playing that character for a long time because they take a long time to post-produce the show and then develop the new series, new story as they go. And they really take as much time as they can get.
Yeah, about a year and a half.
Yeah, a long time. So, yeah. But, you know, it pays off, tightly written show. It's intimidating. I try to tell myself I'm not anxious.
Yeah.
And that in the end, I do know this guy pretty well after all this time. And to some extent, he is whatever my instinct tells me he is. So I just got to trust my instinct. The hardest thing to do, and as I expressed to you a little bit ago, it's actually a bit of a joy, too, is to really disconnect from all the concerns and projects that I generate for myself when I'm not doing that and lose myself in the role. So I need to sit in a corner and look at the blank wall and erase my brain.
Yeah.
And think about who Jimmy McGill is right now and all the things that are going on in his world and what he wants and how he's changed and how he's hoping to change. And so that's the hardest part, but I can do it. Yeah. I will do it.
Yeah. Get in that 2004 mindset where
Jimmy well, you just have to not like fill every minute with something, you know, you literally need to just, you know, erase all the concerns that you have and replace them with somebody else. I need a microchip replacement.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's going to be okay. And the focus is going to happen as soon as I can get to Albuquerque.
I remember last time when you were shooting in Albuquerque, you were able to spend some time I think you did some stand-up shows.
I did some charity events, and we'll do that again this year. I make the cast do improv or whatever they can do, sing a song. And I did stand-up with Brian Posehn when he came through because that was just fun to see my friend.
Yeah.
But I was working on my memoir, which I'm still working on. But, you know, it's pretty all-consuming.
Yeah. Working on your memoir.
Yeah. Yeah, I am.
What's
called Comedy, 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 Drama.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So
it's just a showbiz memoir.
Yeah.
It's just all the jobs I've had and people I work with and things I was trying to do, thought I was trying to do, and did or didn't pull off.
What's it like to be writing that right now at this moment in your career and your life? To be sort of doing that and looking back.
Well,
and
it's no fun to write your memoir. So anybody who thinks that's fun, please take out a piece of paper and let's talk in 3 hours.
Right.
Because, you know, you got to fucking think about the person you like the least in the world, yourself. You may think you like yourself. Take a few minutes and see where you're at. But I'm glad I'm doing it. I chose to do it now. I actually was provoked and prodded to doing it. But pop culture moves so fast. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to write about Mr. Show and even Saturday Night Live days and Get a Life and Ben Stiller's show before those things are completely, totally, utterly submerged under billions of pounds of new TV.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, it really is true that things change so fast. And I really drew this from, you know, my kids who, my daughter likes TV a lot. My son's starting to like it more. My daughter loves movies and really great movies, but I don't think she's ever seen The Graduate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, for you and me, that's like a person who hasn't seen The Graduate is insane to imagine.
But that movie's 50 years old. So, I can see that.
And so you just, and I don't think she's ever seen MASH. Never. Not, I don't think a frame of it. You know what I mean? And
40 years old. Yeah.
But it pop culture and it moves quadruple what it did when we were younger. And so if I want anyone to read something and go, oh yeah, I heard about that, or I remember it, or I saw it, or I got to write it now.
Yeah.
And I also think I've done enough drama now that I don't feel like I'm writing about something I don't know anything about. I'm completely new to. I mean, 3 years ago, it still felt utterly fresh. But I'm not saying I'm an old hand at it, but I just feel more comfortable in it now, and I feel like I can write about it.
Yeah.
So that isn't hard to do. And I personally like showbiz memoirs a lot. I read them in a way that Steve Martin's was so great as a book. It was just a beautiful piece of writing. I don't think I'll achieve that, but I love I even love like the Bogdanovich Orson Welles interviews. You know that
mm-hmm,
book?
Mm-hmm.
It's endless. It's hours and hours of them chatting.
Yeah.
And you can't sit down and read it like a book. You'd go crazy. Who has time? Prisoners would be like, that's enough of that.
Right.
But you read, you know, 10 pages at a time, and you hear about these projects, all these things that he did, Orson Welles did, and all these people he interacted with, and all these projects that went into the toilet. And it's fun. It's just, I love that stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to not be stingy and talk about it. It can be hard to talk about, especially projects that were in the development world that never made it out. But personally, if I was reading someone's career story without needing to hear literally everything, I would want to hear about projects they spent 2 years on that I never saw.
Yeah, those are sometimes more fun because we don't know about them.
And why didn't we see it? And did it work or didn't it work?
And can you bring it back
trying
now?
Trying to judge that can be hard, you know, and there's so many, there's every kind of project in my development years where projects that I think were utterly valuable and achieved their goal and deserved a chance, and then quite a few that I'm like, I'm on the network side. Cut that thing.
Yeah.
Kill this, you know. So I, you know, anyway.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's for
we'll,
for...
we'll talk about it then. It won't be out for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And I'm still working on it.
Well, I think actually when you put it that way, it does make a lot of sense as, you know, those of us in the Generation X, you know, bracket.
Yeah.
As we continue to get a little older and start to feel a little more nostalgic for...
Also, I want to get it over with. I mean, all my friends, they're going to be 60. David Cross is going to be writing his memoir when he's, you know, 65, and I'm going to be laughing at him.
You're like, I did that 10 years ago.
I did that, man. You're way behind.
Yeah, but I mean, I still want to hear more about Ben Stiller's show and Get a Life and all the early 90s classics.
Right.
And again, it's
the exciting thing to talk about in that era is the scene out here in L.A.,
mm-hmm.
the comedy scene. Called the alternative scene at the time, and it was just the start of everything comedy is now.
Yeah,
and it was a group of people, you know, you could count them on two hands, who were doing what everybody's doing now, and we were doing it, and we were encouraging each other and finding very little to no acceptance in the industry for it. And we were all between 5 and 15 years away from succeeding with it.
Yeah, but you're right. That's when comedy sort of this post Letterman, post Simpsons, like, you know, that kind of comedy, I think, changed the game.
Yeah. It was really a fertile, exciting, fun, energetic time with the voices so vastly different from each other. You know, this conversation should take place in 2 years when my book comes
well,
out.
We'll do this again.
But, you know, Margaret Cho, Janine Garofalo, Kathy Griffin, Dana Gould, Patton Oswalt, Brian Posehn, Paul F. Tompkins, David Cross, Greg Behrendt, me, who else? Was in the group. I'm Andy Kindler. You know, just Tenacious D. Everybody you see on Mr. Show. Sarah Silverman, of course.
Yeah. And everyone's still rocking.
Yeah,
everyone's still working. So,
So.
Well,
so, all right.
I'll look forward to that in 2 years or three.
Everybody,
or whatever.
Go watch Pen 15. Episode 9, if you've already watched it, watch episode 9 again and see a masterpiece.
Indeed. And, of course, re-binge Better Call Saul if you haven't lately.
Yeah,
and
sure.
We'll look forward to season 5 sometime in 2020, it sounds like. So we'll get going on that. But
right.
Thanks, Bob. Always a pleasure talking to you.
Great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks. And that's it for this edition of My Favorite Episode. Join us again next time as we once again explore another guest pick. And be sure to subscribe to My Favorite Episode on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or anywhere you download podcasts. Also, head on over to Variety.com for your daily fix of TV news, analysis, and reviews. I'm Michael Schneider, and we'll see you again next time.